I think so often what has happened in criticism is people get put in these like little, these little silos based on their ethnicity or their gender or where they're from. And I think, you know, sometimes being from that group, you go into it with that consciousness of not wanting to be pegged, of wanting your ideas to be evaluated as ideas, not as somehow all being representative of your race.
So you're listening to How Do You Like It So Far, a podcast about popular culture and a changing world.
We're in the middle of dramatic cultural change, and we're also in the middle of learning how to make podcasts. So we're bringing you this podcast in order to reflect on a world in process. Welcome, Carolina Miranda and Elizabeth Mendez-Berry. We're so happy to have you with us here today. Carolina in studio and Elizabeth on the phone, with Henry also on the phone. It's a kind of a coast-to-coast party here on How Do You Like It So Far. Accomplished critics, and also in the case of Elizabeth, now an amazing title of Director of Voice Advocacy. Is that right?
Voice, creativity, and culture.
Come on.
I got it all covered.
Like, how does it get any better than that?
Maybe if there was food involved.
Voice, creativity, and tacos. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's great.
I just saw the picture of you and Daniel Hernandez on the
eating tacos.
Yeah, so what I wanted to start today on this conversation about critics of culture is how each of you kind of came to be in some sense in this way. What attracted you to writing about and reflecting on art and music and culture in the way that each of you have done? You've had kind of each of your own remarkable trajectories. And I just wanted to hear a little bit about how do you, what drew you in and how you got to where you are. Maybe, Carolina, you want to start first?
Sure. It was, I think like most things in my career, I slightly fell into it. I had been a journalist for many years covering a wide range of issues. Elizabeth and I, in fact, met at Time Magazine, where we were both reporters and I was a general assignment reporter. So one minute I might be covering Al-Qaeda in the United States, and the next minute I might be doing an interview with Scarlett Johansson. It was that kind of environment. And I had honestly never, criticism was not something I had aspired to or aimed to do. It was once I started freelancing and writing a lot about art and architecture, I started doing a regular segment on WNYC in New York, where they would invite me to come and speak about the latest shows. And they really, the producer for the show, she was like, you know, be critical, give your opinion, tell us if this show is worthwhile or not. And I remember the first time I went on the radio there, they asked me on air live, you know, what I'm thinking of this. I almost froze, like, oh my God, I'm supposed to give my opinion on this or my views on this. It seemed so terrifying. You know, will I get it right? Will I be wrong? Will I overlook something? And it was really that experience of doing radio and being invited regularly that got me onto the path of the critic, that I had always considered myself a writer, a reporter, you know, someone who could write a good profile. But criticism was not something I had given tons of thought to or something that I thought I could aspire to. I don't have art degrees or architecture degrees. And so I felt like this was out of my reach. But, you know, as I've learned, those who can't do criticize, right? So that's kind of how I landed in it. And then as I've been in it and really begun to follow the work of other critics, you know, Christopher Knight at the LA Times, Christopher Hawthorne, the architecture critic who was there until recently and recently went to work for the city, Roberta Smith at the New York Times, who's a very important critic to me, is, you know, one of the rare female art critics with a very powerful perch in the field, really began to understand how important it is that, you know, criticism is not, we think of it as the opinion, that you're providing an opinion on something. And it can be, but it's also providing context, it's providing background, it's providing history, it's drawing comparisons, it's trying to situate a work of art or an exhibition or a building in some cross currents of history. You know, that really interested me, it, you know, the analytical nature of it, the homework, the talking to people, you know, it's writing. It's essentially, I get to write a research paper every time I write a story for the LA Times.
So. And you don't have to bury the lead, right? You get to say what you think too.
Yeah, I do get to say what I think.
In addition to just like, here's just the facts, ma'am.
Exactly. No, and then you do get to have a point of view, that it doesn't just have to be, here's what one side think, here's what the other sides think, and I'm out. It could be like, here's the debate. Like, I recently did a story about the debate over the redesign of the Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego. It was like, here's the debate. There's controversy over this redesign, and here's what I think of that controversy. And that is very interesting to me, that analytical work. And really, I think a lot of people in the era of Yelp think of criticism as, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down. But that is not what it is. That is not what it is. And the very analytical and nuanced aspects of it appeal to me greatly.
It strikes me that it underscores the importance of what your particular worldview, lived experience, what your background is, where you've come from, is going to inform not just the research side, but especially the sort of the opinion side.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. I think all of our experiences in our areas of knowledge, I have a background. I studied Latin American history with a minor in, with an almost minor. I didn't quite get the degree, but I had almost all the credits.
We'll call it a minor.
In U.S. history, I was very interested in politics and social movements. And so as a result, when I'm looking at art, I'm not just looking at art within the context of art history. You know, how does this painting relate to the paintings that came before it and the paintings that came after it? I'm really thinking about how does that painting, you know, what were the social and political circumstances that led to that painting? What were the social and political circumstances or geographic circumstances that led to the creation of that building? That, you know, art doesn't exist in a vacuum of just art. It exists within society, and there are these myriad forces that shape it. And I think the myriad forces that shape us come into play when we are looking at things. And, you know, just to go back to this story I recently did about the Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego, there had been this controversy over redesign by the architect Annabelle Seldorf because she was going to remove parts of a previous redesign, and the feeling was that that was too valuable of architecture to remove. Well, I've been going to the Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego in La Jolla practically since it was open, and I have a long-term experience of it, and there have always been things about that building that just didn't work. And I felt like my experience of just regularly being in that place and engaging that space and going there with my family, you know, before I was writing art criticism, I was just going to that museum with my family, gave me a different view on how everything functioned. Like a lot of the architecture types were like, no, you can't touch that. That's a sacred piece of architecture. And I was like, well, you can touch that. It's kind of a mess. Like,
so I love the range that you've just brought there, from the stuff that you studied in a formal sense and have, you know, kind of much broader social movement to, like, this is what I do on a Saturday.
Yeah.
As being the kind of the universe of inputs that go into that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all, and everything. Yeah. Everything from, I always say that every experience I have will at some point end up in a piece of writing I do, no matter how banal.
Maybe even this one. Who knows?
Exactly. One day it will end up in a story.
Elizabeth, will you tell us what drew you and how you got started?
Sure. So I could listen to Catalina all day, I have to say. So I really was enjoying that, and I didn't know all of that. So that was great to hear. I was reading the other day this book called What It Means to Write About Art, Interviews with Art Critics by Jarrett Ernest. And he has an interview with Paul Chatsmith, and somebody asks him, how did you start writing on visual artists? And he says, my stock answer, which I think is really mostly true, is that politics got boring and artists were having more fun. And I think it's kind of in some ways the same thing for me. I started, like Carolina, I studied Latin American politics, I studied literature, I did not study music, and I became a music critic, which, you know, I was in college, and I was broke, as many college students are, and there was a sign that said, free tickets in exchange for a review. And to me at that time, these tickets were probably 10 bucks a piece, and I was like, that's a great deal. You know, I was going to get paid significantly less than minimum wage, but I was going to start writing about music. And I think I started doing it basically just for the tickets, and so I could get in and I could see my favorite bands performing. And I realized that I was actually a lot better at that than I was at, you know, the political analysis that I thought would be my life. And particularly for a lot of the reasons that Carolina mentioned, I was always interested in situating the music in its time. And in some ways, you know, I was one of those awful critics who is, I mean, I always cared about the aesthetics, but I also perhaps equally cared about the context. And so I had the character ruining experience of being given the opportunity to write in an alternative weekly at a very, very young age. I think I was 19 or 20 when I started writing for the Toronto Alternative Weekly called I was getting paid 25 bucks per review, which was not a lot of money. I was sustaining myself as a DJ and a waitress, but I was having the time of my life, and I was pontificating at length without a whole lot of context or understanding of what I was doing. But
unburdened
I loved it.
By other, yeah.
And one of the things
unburdened
that,
by self-awareness. Right?
Untroubled, but yes. And one of the things that became apparent to me very early on, first of all, is that I think I'm a critic by nature, which my husband will tell you, going to the movies is the worst with me. Going to a show is the worst, because I just always, I'm always, and I love, that criticism comes out of a place of love, because I really am excited about the potential of the form. But I would say that, you know, most things actually come up short. I always have this response. And one of the kind of powerful experiences that I had early in my career during that period of reckless abandon without being troubled by fact or editorial standards is that, and I'm very thankful that most of that happened pre-internet age, so nobody can really find what I did at that time, was that I was a feminist hip-hop critic at a time when misogyny was part of my local scene in Toronto, but it wasn't as present as it was in kind of the corporate mainstream American hip-hop scene. And what I was able to do was to create a dialogue around gender and power in music and how it manifested itself and the conflicted response that we feel, right? As in many cases, as women, we're indoctrinated with misogyny too, right? And so sometimes we respond to it we enjoy it in a kind of perverse way. And so being able to sort of facilitate some of those conversations, being able to be a bit of a local provocateur or something like that was really an exciting start for me. And I began to really believe that criticism and the space and the oxygen that it opens up around work and the accountability that it offers as well. The notion that it was so important that I was there, and actually a lot of young women came, you know, I became like a tiny little local celebrity because I was out all the time, and because it was a small town and a small scene, people knew who I was, and obviously there were some people who hated me, but there were some people who really appreciated my voice. And so that was just a really potent early experience of the role that criticism can play in our creative ecology. And then from there, I was really fortunate to get a job at Vibe magazine in New York, which was, I was saying the other day on the panel that Carolina joined me for, these are ecologies of excellence, and they're outside the places like Vibe at that time, and the places that are not moderated or limited by the mainstream gaze or the mainstream voice or the mainstream vocabulary, and still are very much in the pursuit of aesthetic excellence. And I think also a political analysis and an understanding of how those two things weave together. That was just, you know, I was in ecstasy, basically, because I just had the opportunity to work around such incredible editors, such incredible writers, and really to get a shot to grow in that space. Like Carolina, I did some reporting. You know, you write features and things like that. But I was also the editor of the music reviews section at Vibe. And at Vibe, being that we were working from an advertising model, you know, you couldn't really get a big feature or the cover in Vibe if you were not with a mainstream record label. It just was not possible. It was all about those advertising dollars. So for the smaller artists, the review space was the only place that a lot of these young artists could come in. And so I took it really, really seriously, and I really appreciated the fact that we would get, you know, these mixtapes, and we would get this crazy packaging to stand out and all this stuff. And I made a huge effort to pull as much as I could those voices into the magazine. And I heard from people, you know, this is Hua Su, who's now at The New Yorker, was one of my writers. He did a lot of really incredible reviews, you know. Some of those artists became big, some of them didn't. But I think that notion of getting feedback from people within your community who care deeply about the form and are taking the time to respond. Obviously, some people, you know, it's challenging when somebody gives you a negative review, is hard, but I think there's also just such enormous value to getting your name out and basically to have somebody say, your work is worth taking seriously, and here's my response. So I could talk a lot more, but I'll stop.
I could listen a lot more. What wonderful experiences, I'm sure, with rife with challenges too, but both really interesting and helpful. And I guess I have to wonder, like, part of that I heard as this incredible role that critics can have, and especially critics who bring perhaps surprising things to the table, not the traditional thing. That I think it's interesting and perhaps informative that each of you were doing work in spaces that you weren't formally trained for. And in some ways, you don't have the resources or the baggage, right? You don't have limitations. And to me, that's, you know, innovation comes from the edges, and that's where outside perspectives come from, people who are new and not burdened by the orthodoxies of the space in the same way.
Yeah, you're not beholden to the sacred cows of whatever that genre is because you come from outside of it. And that is really nice.
So the other thing that, of course, I'm curious about is recognizing that the vast majority of critics writ large are men, especially white men, and recognize that many of them are fabulous and have unique experiences and all kinds of things to offer, but are perhaps more clustered in culture and have a less wide range of experiences than the totality of humanity or than you two. And I wonder, as Elizabeth is talking about misogyny and hip hop, like probably I'm not going to raise that maybe in the same way. A white guy could, of course, but maybe it's going to have a different relationship. Maybe it's harder for women as well. But how do you think about critiquing stuff that might feel close to you or stuff that might feel far from you? Last, when we talked to Jeff Yang, he talked about being kind of the Asian American critic and how that kind of gave him in some ways outsized influence and put him into awkward situations. So it seems like lots of complexity in your identity as it relates to how you're offering your criticism.
Oh, sure. Like, yeah, the personal relationships part is always, if you're Latina coming down hard on a Latina artist, it, you know, there's that feeling of like, oh, wow, that really stings, you know, like, because we do not live in a society where there are a lot of A, Latinas getting museum shows and B, Latinas as critics. But I think going back to the larger point, I think, you know, any place wants to have a diversity of critics because you want that diversity of viewpoints. And what has happened so much in criticism is that the viewpoints have been, you know, very white and very male and from the East Coast. That tends,
so very kind of traditional,
yeah,
on top of it all.
This,
like traditional,
like Northeastern,
squared.
Yeah, like Yale and, you know, Ivy Leagues and all that good stuff. And that is not bad. I'm not by any means despective about that. I think it's just that we have a wider range of voices in our society and therefore need a wider range of critical voices. And so, for example, at the LA Times, you know, we have 9 critics in the calendar section, counting like music and art and film. And, you know, only one is a woman and only one is a person of color. So this is an area. And part of it is that, you know, critics tend to hang out in their roles for a long time. Once you become a critic somewhere, it's kind of arrived.
You're living large.
You get to do things like see movies or look at buildings and art exhibitions and write about them. But I think it's so critical. And when I think about it in the context of Los Angeles, you know, this is a city that is majority minority, that is almost 50% Latino, that the experience here, you know, this is where Latin America meets Asia. That is our, you know, the Korean taco is Los Angeles, I think, culture written in a piece of food. And I think we need critics that understand that those realities, that are not looking at those realities consistently from outside, that are not exoticizing them, because I think that tends to happen, especially, like, you know, I sometimes read like older reviews by unnamed previous critics in other publications, and you find, you know, it's like the stereotypes of Latino artists is somewhat like dangerous and always emerging from the barrio. And, you know, it's always like there's never like a panoply of thought or experience. It's always people kind of put into these little pigeonholes or
that we're all very familiar with.
Yeah,
it's like
or these
story
ideas.
We
exactly.
Know,
right? Or like, you know, I always think about this interview I did with the artist Gronk. He is a painter and he's also a set designer. He works with the opera director Peter Sellers a lot. He was part of that very influential art collective ASCO in the 1970s. And he talks about like doing interviews with people and they're like, oh, your color palette must be wildly influenced by, you know, traditional Mexican crafts. And he's like, no, it's wildly influenced by all the Vincent Minnelli movies I grew up watching because he's a film buff. And so I think it's having critics who understand that nuance, that I as a Latina exist in the world at large, and therefore Latino artists also exist in the world at large, and their influences can be as varied as any influences I have as a writer, which, you know, run from Bruce Chatwin to Alma Guillermo Prieto. You know, like I'm looking at the vast range.
Alma.
Love her. You know, at the vast range of cultural output, and artists are too. And I think so often what has happened in criticism is people get put in these like little silos based on their ethnicity or their gender or where they're from. And I think, you know, sometimes being from that group, you go into it with that consciousness of not wanting to be pegged, of wanting your ideas to be evaluated as ideas, not as somehow all being representative of your race. And so that's been really critical to me. And it's something I've always been really careful about in my writing, in terms of like, how do I approach a story? Am I making assumptions, just the way assumptions are made about me? You know, I've been through many jobs where the assumption is I would only write about Latino things, because obviously that's what the Latino would do.
Right.
And I'm like, no, I'm here. You know, as I said at the conference with Elizabeth this past weekend, I'm like, I'm here to write about it all. I want to own it all. I will write about Frank Gehry, and I will also write about Pacific Standard Time Latin America shows. Like, I engage the broader society, but I feel like I can do it with an eye of someone who has been put in that box, and therefore am conscientious about what it means to be put in that box.
And it seems like one of the things that happens, I mean, this is from Mauricio Mota talking about success within a genre, like, oh, that's a Latino show or whatever. Yeah. And it may be big in that universe, but somehow is kind of kept up,
yeah,
kept into that box and not allowed to kind of traverse into broader culture.
Exactly.
So there, it seems like lots of structures, identities, and just our standard MO to kind of be wanting to put everything in their pigeonhole.
Exactly.
And be happy with
and it. And that somehow that pigeonhole is not American, that when we think of American, I just did a story on Guadalupe Rosales, the Chicana artist who has a show at the Vincent Price Art Museum. And she works a lot with vernacular photography of 1990s Latino youth, you know, those like star shots and flyers from party crews and this whole like underground music scene and party scene that was going on in the 1990s.
Right.
You know, and I always say, if you think like 1990s LA youth culture, what are you thinking? And people are like, oh, Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place.
This
and,
is a whole, yeah, know, these photos are
and,
awesome.
And the idea that Chicano youth could be LA youth, could be American youth, is something that I think, you know, new generations of critics can bust open, that they will not be put in this box as this Latino thing, but instead as this LA thing, and as this music thing, and as this underground party scene thing, and as an artistic thing, and that, you know, the Venn diagram can exist in many ways. It doesn't just exist in that box.
So,
well, we're at a moment where there has been such an increasing visibility of minority representation across all arts, and particularly in popular culture. So why is the gap in critics persisting as dramatically as it seems to be?
Well, I think that's for a couple of reasons. One is media is in, you know, since we're allowed to swear, it's in the shitter. You know, it's like the first thing that gets cut when a newspaper is laying people off is the critics, because it's like, you know, well, what are they generating in terms of clicks and revenue and so on and so forth, especially fine art critics. Like, the fine art section is usually like music and film people will hold on to for a little while, but fine arts is often the first to go. So I think there can be less viable platforms for criticism. And by viable, I mean, you know, paying you economically viable to the writer. You know,
we're back to the $25 a review.
Exactly. There are many ways to be a critic and there are many ways to be influential, but can you make a living at it? And I think the uncertainty in media has certainly put a lot of those positions, you know, has eliminated a lot of those positions. How many newspapers in America have a full-time art critic? It's only a handful. So I think that's part of it. And then I think it's like I said earlier, you know, criticism is one of those, like, within the world of a newspaper, of a magazine, it's like you're the tenured professor. Like, you're going to be there for a while. Like,
yes,
you've
Henry,
got
we know
gig.
How those are.
And so I think it moves, the turnover of critic moves slower than the turnover of exhibitions at a museum.
Okay.
But we're starting to see that shift now.
But I mean, so I'm of course totally compelled by the case that you both made and that I heard last week about sort of the power of critics and a more diverse range of critics in, mm-hmm, all senses. And that seems to be at odds with this experience, right? Like, they're going to do better criticism. If we have if you don't have the mix you have currently at the LA Times,
yeah,
for instance, you're going to have a more interesting range of insights and experiences and be able to play a different role. So I get that there's kind of a blockage in big newspapers and so on, and sort of limited slots, and people mm-hmm. aren't slots and people aren't turning over. But that seems like it creates an opportunity for disruption, not just in the Yelp space of of critics, but of other of blogs or other yes. kinds of the, you know, the alternative magazine that Elizabeth talked about. So what's the what are the either the competitors or the feeders ecosystem look like, where critics get to develop their voice, kind of develop their craft, and otherwise engage either with the ultimate trajectory of getting a bigger, you know, getting one of those tenured gigs, which mm-hmm. they deserve, or having impact in a way, ideally, that's financially sustainable. What does that sort of ecosystem look like?
Well, that ecosystem is all over the place right now. I actually came to this through blogging. I mean, I had worked as a reporter at Time Magazine. I had worked as a reporter at a number of other places. And when I left Time and went into freelancing, I started a blog because I felt like, you know, this is going to be the one place where I can just be myself. I don't have to be writing for some institutional voice. I can just be me. I can be critical. I can do whatever I want. I can try things out. I can experiment. I can fail. And so that's how I really came to it. And I feel like, you know, that was in a moment when blogging was very hot. Blogging is not, as you know, now everyone has a Medium account. You know, it's got to be networked. Yep. But I think that the internet has provided all of these really interesting platforms for criticism. You have Black Arts, started by Jessica Lynn, that is looking at Black contemporary art and features criticism about Black contemporary art. And that is the kind of thing, like, if she had had to publish her own magazine or fund her own alternative newsletter, it would have been far more prohibitive than it is now. So the internet is providing this platform for this wide range of audiences that through social media then find their own niche audiences. And that has been very critical, that ecosystem. As newspapers and magazines fail, there the internet has kind of picked that up. So the voices are still there. I think it's the financial question.
I was
going
to say, are they sustainable? I mean, is that...
Yeah, the financial... Yeah, a lot of
In your 120% time after you do your 45 hours a week or whatever it is, then you get to come home and then spend another 25 on that.
Exactly, and write a review.
I agree with Carolina. I mean, I think the kind of democratization that has resulted from online spaces is amazing, and it created space for people like Catalina to build the blog, build the audience, even though, you know, the blog is no longer the thing. The name is different, but the kind of substance is the same. I think the massive problem is that the economics are all off, right? So many people are writing for free. What that has meant is that they're writing for free on social media, and I think on social media you also see an enormous amount of criticism. And so, you know, if we get a chance to talk a little bit about Critical Minded, which is the initiative that the Ford Foundation and Nathan Cummings Foundation, where I work, are working on, and Carolina's a part of as well, you know, a big goal for us is, on the one hand, we want to support critics, individual critics, but on the other hand, we really want to make critical thinking more and more accessible and more valued and recognized. And so in many ways, you know, what's happened on Twitter has, you know, in addition to the awful trolling and shrillness and all that, there's also some really exciting, nuanced debates happening, and a way that people are in real time comparing notes and building arguments and then taking them apart and then building them up again and shifting and all of that. So there's what I would say is really, really exciting stuff happening, but the economics of it all are just really challenging. So one of the things that I noticed is that when you see a guest, a sort of cultural critic in one of the bigger publications, chances are that person will be an academic. And I love you all academics. I think you're fabulous. You're brilliant.
We need you.
But I actually think that there really is a need for a cultural critic at large who is not institutionalized in that way, right? So I think this is one of the key issues that we're tackling in our work.
Well, I'd love to hear more about it. I mean, I've just in sort of doing research for this conversation, I've seen, you know, some progress in aspects of the field. So you see like Toronto International Film Festival and Sundance, you know, reserving low-cost kind of access for critics of color, or Rotten Tomatoes, trying to address mm-hmm. the problem in some ways, right?
Yes.
But
yeah.
Not getting at what you're talking about, which is...
The financial.
Yeah, the real, like the baseline financial thing, which is, I mean, and the related piece for me is, one is like, how do you pay for it? And then the other is sort of the discoverability part. Like, so yes, internet and related technologies have lowered the cost, the barriers to entry. You can have a beautiful looking magazine-esque kind of thing online, but so can everyone else. So there's a lot of voices out there.
Exactly.
How do we find, you know, how do we find these great voices? And, you know, if you're operating outside an institution, which is great, how do you develop your craft? Who is your editor? Who is your co-conspirator? Do you do that with your audience? It seems like, on one hand, you're not limited in the same way perhaps that you are by like a tyrannical team, but the way that, you know, you were talking about vibe, you're with these other colleagues who are not the same as you and have different experiences and trainings and so on, and who are helping to you to learn. So it feels like it's a real, I mean, that, I guess that's why I asked it as an ecosystem question, because it just feels like so many different pieces need to come together.
There are two big things that come to mind for me. One is that, you know, the move with Toronto International Film Festival and some momentum around Sundance, you know, it's exciting, it's important. I think a lot of it, from what I understand of the kind of behind the scenes of that, Time's Up has made a big, big difference, because Time's Up has taken on this question of who does film criticism and who, you know, who's validating, who's assessing the work. So to the point that was made earlier around that disconnect between the increasing visibility of artists of color and yet the persistence of a much more white critic corps. One of the things that I'm really interested in and curious about is how do we extend that activism so that there's a generalized or at least an increased awareness of the value of criticism and the need for criticism. It has economic consequences, right? If the same three critics are reviewing every single theater production that might be considered for Broadway and they all have the same viewpoint, which is kind of pretty much the case that we're dealing with right now, the economic consequences of that are huge, in addition to the intellectual consequences of the lack of opportunities for those ideas to get out. So that's a huge piece that I think within Critical Minded we're thinking about, is how do we activate folks to understand why this is important for them? Because I think, especially because so many people are sort of participating in critical thinking through their social media identities, you know, people who maybe previously weren't publicly pontificating about Black Panther are suddenly writing a 3-page essay and sharing it with their 82 friends, you know? I'm hoping that we can kind of capture that momentum and move it towards a broader discourse. And then the other thing about editorial support, this is one of the big challenges, I think, about what happens online. I've been hearing that younger writers are getting sort of pushed to write sensationalistic articles or, you know, write a really scathing critique of somebody more established to make your name, but nobody's actually taking care of the quality of your writing or encouraging you to build a sustainable career. So one of our questions is, how do we support the scaffolding that allows for people to be creating higher quality work online, and also to encourage people to move towards a more nuanced analysis, like Catalina was saying, with context, not a hit piece, right? Because I think most critics are not really interested in hit pieces, because hit pieces are not representative of how we feel about most of the stuff we see. Most of the stuff we see, we like certain aspects of it, we don't like certain aspects of it. We have all of these complex feelings, and to me, the best criticism engages that, interrogates that, versus just, you know, slamming it.
Part of what was so critical about Critical Minded for me, you know, even being at a staff job at the LA Times, is being in this room with critics from myriad areas, some of whom are doing experimental magazines, some of whom work for mainstream media. And I think just in that, in pulling all of those people together in a room, part of what Elizabeth has done is sort of like, okay, the ecosystems that previously nurtured this work are kind of falling apart. Let's create our own ecosystem. And that ecosystem starts with, let's get in a room together and meet. You know, like it's that basic. And then I think, and then now some of the work that she's doing in terms of providing microgrants so that some of these critics can hold events, invite a speaker, do some kind of public happening or gather with other writers, that kind of support, that kind of financial support that's being given is so important to what you address, Colin, to that idea of like, okay, being in an environment where you're with people who are unlike yourself and who are asking questions and pushing you to be a better thinker.
I mean, it always feels to me like when you're kind of doing something different, that it's exciting, but one of the hardest things is you're uncertain and it can feel really lonely and scary. not hard because it's long hours, that's hard, but really hard because you're not sure if you're doing it the right way. Yeah. And you want to do it the best you can, and you don't want to do it only the way it's been done. Having that, having community and people that you trust or can appreciate the journey you're on is just invaluable.
Exactly. And somebody to bounce ideas off of, like, hey, you know, I'm having trouble opening this story.
Yeah.
Should I open with this or with this?
Or, I mean, and going back to some of the particular challenges that critics of color may face in dealing with, in air quotes, their own community, or that, you know, like the those really thorny questions that may be personal of how do I navigate the fact that I felt this way about this piece, you know, and be able to talk to someone else who's been in that same position.
Exactly.
Henry, did you want to jump in?
Yeah. So one of the things I'm listening to this, criticism is being equated with writing throughout this conversation. When I'm looking at cultural criticism today, and particularly for minority critics, I'm turning to podcasts. Right, which mm-hmm. is where we're hearing a lot more voices. So I'm trying to figure out, do you see podcast as such a radically different infrastructure? Do we see something particular about written criticism that we want to put our emphasis on? Or are we just being a little sloppy and assuming that criticism is always going to be a written form?
Well, I did start by saying that I did criticism on the radio, so.
See, this is professors. We forget. We just talk. We don't.
I will. You know, I absolutely. It occurs in myriad forms, and I think in my area, which happens to be fine arts and architecture, there are some important podcasts, but a lot of it happens writing wise, and I think part of it is because it's a visual medium. Like, I'm showing paintings, I'm showing buildings, and there's something about being able to show the work that you're discussing that can be helpful. Like, on the way here, I was listening to Song Exploder, and that is this, you know, brilliant podcast that deconstructs a work of musical art that so works for the medium of sound.
Rishikesh Hirway, made here in LA.
Exactly. And so yeah, I think podcasts are absolutely a viable outlet, just like, you know, I'd love to see people do YouTube reviews of things. But I think in terms of at least my area, which is art and architecture, I think people tend to lean towards writing simply because of the visual aspect.
I think you should do Building Exploder, but that might
a Building
be
Exploder.
The wrong
way. Yeah, exactly. Then I definitely get arrested by the NSA.
I would just say from the critical minded perspective, we are very much open to whatever form criticism takes. What we have found thus far is that, and this is not in any way, you know, binding, but a lot of the podcasts we're most fans of are hosted by writers. Right? Our question is, where are the ideas? And less about what the package is. And, you know, I think our hope is, certainly it keeps coming up, everybody wants a critical-minded podcast because the critics who are part of this community are just brilliant. And every time they, you know, when they're in dialogue, it's a pretty extraordinary conversation most of the time. And so we're definitely open to that. I think the other thing is being curious about the economic opportunities. As I said, I'm very particularly interested in the social media question because I think that the notion of how critical thinking travels, how discourse travels, how ideas about a piece of artwork, you know, dissecting what happened at the Whitney last year or dissecting the conversation around Black Panther or Sorry to Bother You, some of these big films, sometimes the more interesting conversation, or Coco, right? Coco was not reviewed by any Latinx critics, right? And in any of the big publications where it was reviewed, which is, in my opinion, shocking, right? But there were tons of amateur, you know, social media critics who were having lots of conversations about it. So in order to understand the full picture of what people thought about the film, you had to go in all of these different places. And I think our hope is, you know, and this is probably going to be a research question, is how to better understand how those ecologies work together and also the economics of them.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the piece that you wrote, Elizabeth, on Black Panther and Coco and Critics of Color, which will be on the website along with this podcast, was great. And I guess I'm compelled by, it feels like there is a pretty substantial alignment of interest. Like, we need more diverse critics. It works, right? The industry needs it. I don't know if I'm a consumer, a user, an appreciator of all kinds of artistic works. I want that sort of guidance. The creators, the makers want feedback. So it feels like our incentives should be aligned. Like, we none of us are benefiting from the place we are now. And I love hearing about Critical Minded and how you're kind of pushing on things to get us there. And I guess my question is, or one question is, what are you most excited about? Where do you feel like the promise is? How do we kind of accelerate that progress beyond the Critical Minded podcast, which, by the way, sounds like a great idea? What are the bright spots?
Can I actually, before we get to that, can I just say one thing to what you just said, which is that not everyone wants criticism. We're actually in a moment, our president certainly doesn't want criticism, and actually a lot of artists don't want criticism. There is, I don't know, Carolina, if this is something that you've experienced, but I think because there was a period, the world that I was, more focused on, the hip-hop world, where everybody was reading Vibe, everybody was reading The Source, and so I shared a story about how, Jay-Z read an essay that I wrote, which was very critical of him, and he, responded to it in a really positive way. That obviously didn't always happen, but it did happen quite a bit. But now that artists are able to circumnavigate the media via their own social media identities, some artists are like, screw this. Like, I don't want to have anything to do with these. I don't want to hear. I don't want, Chance the Rapper, when a critic on MTV News posted a kind of marginally negative but mostly laudatory review of one of his shows, Chance and his management threatened to stop any association with MTV. And they, in fact, wound up precipitating the closure of the MTV News team, which was an incredible experiment in longer form music journalism. And it was heartbreaking that that happened. And it happened not just because of him, but he was one of many. So I don't want to be sort of Pollyanna-ish about that everybody loves criticism, because I don't think everybody, it's hard to contend with criticism. All of us feel that way. It's hard to deal with honest feedback if it's not, 3,000% positive. And I do think that that's part of the challenge that we face.
Thank you for that correction. Indeed, I know that to be true. Even in just the conversation preparing for this show, I talked to a showrunner and he was like, I hate critics. Critics are terrible. They should just leave, show it to the audience, and then let them decide. And I get that. But I also, so thank you for that correction. I'm looking at the clock, and sadly, I think we got to wrap this up. But I want to hear any last words from you, Henry.
No, I want to hear what the bright spots are. Yeah. Where we have hope.
All right,
don't
leave
end
us
on how bad the role of critic is. I want to know what.
I think we are in a moment. It's interesting because I'm working on a story right now that I don't want to give too much away on, but it is this idea of we are in the best of times, we are in the worst of times. And I think what happens in these moments of social and cultural and political instability, and certainly media instability, because right now our media outlets are kind of up for grabs, especially when it comes to print, it's also this moment of incredible opportunity, because I think people will take risks that they didn't take before. They will do things that maybe they wouldn't have done before when everything was like easy and you went from point A to point B. I mean, I even think of like basic things like my getting hired at the LA Times. Like, I don't fit the profile, the typical profile of art writer. I didn't study art. I didn't study architecture. I don't have advanced degrees. I didn't go to the Whitney Independent Study Program. Like, on paper, I'm a terrible art writer. And I think the fact that everything
on
has...
On paper, you're also a great one.
I was gonna say, yeah, that was...
But I think it's exactly that has given me the platform I have, because I come at things from a completely different point of view. And I also think the fact that things are kind of shaky does make publications such as the LA Times say, hey, she doesn't fit the traditional bill of an art writer, but, she's built something else. So let's give that a platform. And would that have happened 20 years ago? I don't think so. I don't think so. And so I see in these moments of chaos, which it is a moment of chaos, I also see opportunity. This is like old institutions are crumbling, but new ones are in the process of being built. And I feel like we can have a hand in building those. And I feel like that is something that I try to do with every story at the LA Times, but that also, something that like Elizabeth is thinking about with Critical Minded, like how are we going to shape how criticism happens and is remunerated and is culturally supported in the future. So I think it's a scary time, but it's a fabulous time as well.
I'll take the
fabulous
part.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I would just add that, obviously this political moment is feeling apocalyptic for many people in many ways. And I think that is the time when you remember that art is our collective imagination, right? Art is the space of vision beyond what feels currently possible. And so the discourse around art, the degree to which those ideas migrate is essential right now. And what I love, you know, what is so exciting is that people are really, I mean, the podcasts, as you mentioned, the social media conversations, there's some just the writing, the goosebump generating writing. I think things are changing. I think the thing that is not changing yet is economics, right? So that's where we have to come in, where philanthropy, I think, as I mentioned, the advertising model was not great either, right? It really did have its limitations in terms of who was going to be on the cover, who was going to get a real feature, who was going to be taken seriously. You know, obviously philanthropy isn't perfect and we're not the superheroes to save the day, but at the very least to think about how the cultural conversation can progress by shining a light and supporting these phenomenal voices. And I would also say we have momentum that we've never had before. You know, Stacey Smith's study, the Time's Up conversations, and it's happening in theater and it's happening in dance. Critics are starting to stand up, and also artists are starting to stand up for a criticism that actually they can relate to, and where, you know, the critic understands their artistic lineage and respects it, even if they don't agree with all of the decisions that the artist makes, for example. So I've been following this for years. I've been in philanthropy for now 8 years, and I've never felt as much momentum as I do in this moment. So I'm excited.
Well, thank you, Carolina and Elizabeth, especially for that uplifting bit at the end, but for all of the insights that you've shared and the work that you have done and are doing.
You can just send checks to the robot at the bottom of the...
Well, I learned a lot from this discussion. It's been really illuminating.
We have a guy with an open suitcase outside. You could just deposit your singles right there.
Elizabeth has the checks. Come on.
I need you. I'm fundraising.
And thank you for pronouncing my name right. That's pretty remarkable.
So I really enjoyed that conversation. My only regret was that even though it went long, it felt like it was too short. We were just really getting started. You know, for me, as I mentioned, Elizabeth was really the one who kind of opened my eyes about this issue, or began to, and get me kind of curious and understand how important critics of color, having critics of color, was, and how few we had, especially in positions of sort of visibility, audibility, influence. So I was thrilled to be able to bring her into the studio as an accomplished former critic and someone who's, you know, sort of driving this agenda in exciting ways. And then to be able to bring Carolina as a current critic who kind of came in, as she said, through the side door and has a really interesting portfolio. And as she said, the only critic of color at the LA Times in this, you know, vibrant, multicultural, diverse city, helping us navigate it and the world through her perspective, just seemed like a great opportunity to bring past and current critics together who are looking at how we change these dynamics of the space. So that was my aim in having that conversation. And I felt like it was a great start. And of course, I want to get into more deeply where we go from here and how their effort called Critical Minded is proceeding, and really how we change this ecosystem.
I have found this entire series really eye-opening. Certainly, I was aware of the question of critics of color and how few we've seen, but I never really thought through as deeply as I should have the implications of all of that at a moment where our mediascape is changing so radically. And I think each participant in our panel and our discussion so far has brought something vital to my understanding of these issues. And I'm excited to be having us sit down next week with Eric Deggans, who is the first full-time television critic hired for National Public Radio, a regular guest on Pop Culture Happy Hour these days, and the author of a book, Race Baiter, How Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. And he's a really interesting guy for a number of reasons. One is he brings in audio, and we had a brief discussion here about the role of audio, not just radio, but increasingly podcast, in expanding access to diverse perspectives on the media landscape. And if I encounter work by critics of color these days, it's as often or not on podcast as any place else. And Eric has certainly had interesting things to say about that. His book, Race Baiter, really gives us a broader context for thinking about the struggles that are going on in television at the moment. And that book deals an awful lot with news, which is a category of cultural production we've generally not touched on because the discussion so far has been so much in the entertainment space. But this is another place where critics of color are playing an important role responding to the divisive rhetoric and the lack of representation in television news. And I think Eric will have interesting things to say about that as well. And a third way I think we can extend our discussion is to think about the role of critics in relation to awards, the Emmys, the Academy Awards, something like the Peabody's, which Eric is very much involved with, how they are do or do not respond to agendas that are set by critics well in advance of the point where their membership are considering what to nominate, what to vote on. In some ways, critics pre-select what screeners, voters watch in these award categories. And so if in recent years the slogan has been Oscar so white, it may well be a byproduct of the fact critics so white. So these are things I hope we'll get to take up next time.
That sounds great. Yeah, as I've kind of learned more about the, made the rounds of the compass in this ecosystem, and just all these things that were not visible to me as sort of a more casual viewer, listener, appreciator of these different media that folks make, it's really just sort of, I feel like I'm peeling back the layers of the onion as we understand more how critics can, do, should function within this ecosystem and why it's so important to have a wider range of voices. Well, this has been great, Henry. Thanks so much for those thoughts and for lining up Eric next week. I'm really excited.
Onward and upward.
Here goes. I'd love it. There's plenty I can tell Eric.
As always, this is How Do You Like It So Far, a podcast about popular culture and a changing world.
Our show is wonderfully produced by Andrea Alarcón, Renny Svernovsky, and Sophie Maggi.